Morning, brothers and sisters. I'd first like to say thank you to everyone who's worked so hard on this gathering. I know for us Bereans, this week is the highlight of our year. And Sister Keely and I are very thankful for everyone's efforts to make it all happen. I'd also like to thank all the brethren who have given opening remarks so far or made comments for the study classes. This has definitely been uplifting for me so far, and hopefully we can continue that today. So we will continue our study of the book of Esther this morning with chapters 5 and 6. I would like to classify these chapters as the turning point in the story. And quickly, I'd like to recap what we have covered so far, as I think it's important as we start chapter 5. So prior to these chapters, we have the introduction of the characters, and we learn about the dire situation that Esther, Mordecai, and the rest of the Jews have been put in. We have learned that this was all fueled by the hatred of one man, Haman. In chapter 3, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman above all the other princes, which means that he had great power, and essentially, he was the king's right-hand man. The king had commanded all of his servants to bow before Haman and give him reverence. Mordecai, however, would not do so. Haman's hatred for Mordecai was so strong that he convinced the king to write a decree that called for the destruction of all Jews. From chapters 2 and 4, we have been able to figure out that God was working providentially through Esther. Her purpose in becoming queen was to ultimately save her people, the Jews, from this terrible decree. For now, we will reference chapter 4, and later on, we will reference chapter 2. So in chapter 4 that we discussed yesterday morning, Mordecai urges Esther to go before the king and make a request to him for her people. Esther replies to Mordecai by reminding him that she could be put to death if the king did not hold out the golden scepter to her, as she had been unbidden by the king, and she would be showing up without being called. Mordecai gives Esther encouragement to go forward with her request, even though it would be dangerous for her to do so. He suggests that perhaps this was the very reason that she even became queen in the first place. So Esther agrees to the plan and asks Mordecai and the Jews to pray and fast for her. And here we can see a parallel to Christ in that Esther was willing to give her life in order to try to save her people. Jesus told his disciples in John chapter 15, verse 13, "Greater love hath no man than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends." So with this in mind, we begin chapter 5. And as we begin, we can feel the tension as we read of Esther preparing herself and going to stand before the king. Esther would surely have been familiar with the fate of the previous queen, Vashti, who was put away after she disobeyed the king's commandments. With this in mind, it must have been extremely difficult to find the courage to go through with the plan and present herself before the king. However, she placed her full faith in God, and her faith would be rewarded. Verse 2 says that she obtained favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Here Esther stood before the king. What a striking contrast she was to that of Queen Vashti. As was discussed earlier in the week, Esther possessed not only outer beauty, but also an inner beauty that drew people towards her. The king looked at her with kindness and asked, "What wilt thou, Queen Esther, and what is thy request? It shall be given thee to the half of the kingdom." However, Esther was not yet ready to tell the king her mission. Not only had she prayed and fasted unto God, but she had also carefully planned the manner of her approach to the king. Haman had previously worked on the king by guile, and so Esther realized that she had to meet guile with prudence and match his cunning scheming with her faith. She had to move carefully and prudently in order to secure the fullest confidence and affection of the king. She first invited both the king and Haman to join her at a banquet that she had prepared. The king, of course, was more than willing to agree to this request. So the king and Haman came to the banquet prepared by Esther. Haman no doubt showed up feeling that it was an honor to be invited to such an event. Throughout the banquet, however, Esther did not yet make her petition known. She was waiting for the right time to do so. As the banquet was coming to an end and the wine was being served, the king asked Esther what she desired. In verse 6, he asks her again, "What is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? Even to the half of the kingdom it shall be performed." For some reason, Esther felt it was best to delay the matter. She answered the king and again invited both him and Haman to a second banquet to be held the next day, at which time she would reveal her petition to the king. This was agreed upon, and the banquet came to an end. The second half of chapter 5 gives us a better look at Haman and his character. From the remaining verses 9 through 14, we see just how much of a prideful, vain, and jealous man that Haman was. He left the queen's banquet very pleased with himself and with his life in general. His schemes of personal advancement were succeeding beyond his greatest expectations. It was obvious to him that the queen wanted to pay him a high honor, and he knew that he also enjoyed the greatest favor of the king. However, as he left the palace, there he saw in the gate his enemy, the despised Jew, Mordecai. And of course, Mordecai did not bow before him or acknowledge his glory. This completely ruined Haman's day. We can see here just how vain and prideful he really was. He hated Mordecai's act of defiance more than he loved his great achievements in his life. When he arrived home, he spoke to his family and his friends about the glory of his power, the wealth of his family, and the honor the king paid him in promoting him above all his princes and servants. He tells them that Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king but himself, and that he was invited again with the king tomorrow. And then in verse 13, he says, "Yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." On Monday morning, Brother Ben made a comment about King Ahasuerus having great riches and power, but when Vashti disobeyed him, he was so upset that none of it mattered. And this is the exact same way that Haman reacts here to Mordecai. I had not made this connection before on my own, before he made his comment, so that's just something that I wanted to share with you guys as well. Haman's wife, Zeresh, shared the same bitter feelings towards Mordecai that Haman had. She fed the vindictive nature of Haman by revealing the greatest impatience against Mordecai. She urged him to exercise his authority by ordering a special death of humiliation and degradation for Mordecai, that all the people might see and ponder the fate of those who oppose the great Haman. Chapter 5 ends with Haman commanding for a gallows 50 cubits high to be made, and his plan was to have Mordecai hanged on it. Haman was pleased with the solution and no doubt retired for the night, joyfully anticipating to join the king at the banquet on the following day. Chapter 6 begins this very same night, and here we can see God working providentially to an even greater extent. As I mentioned earlier, God had a plan that began with Mordecai in chapter 2. If we revisit chapter 2, verses 21 through 23, we will read of the foundation of this plan. It says, "In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen. And Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king." So returning to the start of chapter 6, we learn that the king could not sleep on this very same night. So to occupy his mind, he commanded the book of records of the Chronicles to be brought and read to him. And within this book, it recorded the service that Mordecai had rendered the throne by reporting the conspiracy of Bigthan and Teresh against the king, and thereby saving his life. The king inquires, "What honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this?" "There is nothing done for him," was the reply. So the king decided that he would rectify this the following day. The king now had a new appreciation for Mordecai and what he had done for him, and this undoubtedly was an important turning point that foreshadows the rest of this story. The following day was one of great significance for all parties involved. Esther, Haman, and the king were each anxious to put into effect the plans they had made the night before. Esther wanted to present her petition. The king wanted to reward Mordecai, and Haman wanted permission to hang him. Haman was the first to act, as he had to carry out his plan early enough in the day to still make it to Esther's banquet. Early in the morning, he arose and hastened to the palace to petition the king. When the king learns that Haman had arrived to the court, he was delighted to bring him in. Here was the man who was best qualified to advise him how to reward Mordecai. So the king poses his question to Haman. What shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? This unexpected question drove all thoughts of Mordecai from Haman's thoughts. He had to take advantage of this opportunity, for whom would the king delight to honor more than himself? So after considering how he could personally benefit from such an honor, he gave his reply in verses 7 through 9. For the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought which the king useth to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head, and let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man withal whom the king delighteth to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. Knowing that Haman thought the king was referring to him, this was a very daring and presumptuous suggestion. He envisioned himself being paraded through the city, being seen as a man bearing royal approval, receiving the applause of the people. However, he would soon experience the truth of Proverbs chapter 29, verse 23, which says, "A man's pride shall bring him low, but honor shall uphold the humble in spirit." Haman's pride was brought crashing down by the king's next statement. He listened with mortification as the king commanded, "Make haste and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do so even to Mordecai the Jew that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken." What humiliation this was for Haman. The people, already perplexed at the proclamation of the king against the Jewish people that had been engineered by Haman and sent out under the royal seal, would be utterly confused at the sight of Haman, the Jews' enemy, publicly honoring Mordecai, who had openly shown his contempt for Haman. But of course, Haman could not refuse the king's commands, lest he risk his life. And so he honored Mordecai as the king directed. What dark, bitter thoughts must have flooded Haman's mind as he was made to carry this out. And what an amazing reversal for Mordecai. Lifted upon the horse, he must have pondered the ways of providence as he looked down upon his enemy walking before him. He must have realized that God was working for the relief of his people and that this constituted a token of ultimate deliverance. In this turn of events, we see a wonderful answer to Mordecai's prayers. From doing some research, I found it interesting that from the king's previous statement to Haman concerning Mordecai the Jew, we can infer that the king did not realize that it was to the Jews that Haman was referring to when he made his infamous suggestion that some subjects in the empire were opposed to the king and should be destroyed. Haman notably did not name the people when he laid out his accusation. The king trusted him and was confident that he was acting in the best interest of the crown. In fact, as we learned earlier, the king also did not even know that Esther was a Jew, as we learned from chapter 2 that she had hidden her people and kindred from him, as Mordecai had instructed her to do. This point only adds even more conviction that God was indeed working providentially through Mordecai and Esther. Having done as the king commanded in honoring Mordecai, Haman quickly returned home. He was depressed, worried, and fearful at the turn of events. and so he covered his head as he made his way home. Upon arrival, he told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends what had happened. He heard some wise but depressing words of warning from both Zeresh and his wise men. They declared, "If Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews, before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shalt surely fall before him." They knew of the history of the Jews, how God had been with them and brought punishment upon those who persecuted them. Therefore, their advice to Haman was to make peace with his enemy, who would otherwise prove too much for him. But it was too late. Even while they were talking with him, the king's chamberlain called to bring Haman to the banquet that Esther had prepared. His day of opportunity was at an end. And this is how chapter 6 concludes. As we look back and summarize chapters 5 and 6, we can see two common themes. First is the absolute faith of both Esther and Mordecai. They found themselves the subject of extreme persecution along with the rest of the Jews. However, they fully placed their faith in God and prayed constantly for deliverance. God rewarded their faith by working through both of them providentially to deliver his people. As we read countless times throughout the Bible, we know what happens to those who oppose God. The second theme is the prideful arrogance of Haman. He is the perfect example of how we should not live our lives. He was so vain, so self-centered. His motivation for everything he did was personal gain, and he badly wanted to be revered by the king and his empire. And we will find out from the remaining chapters, as we will find out from the remaining chapters, God rewarded his selfishness accordingly. Let this be a lesson to us that we may try our best to do everything according to God's will and not our own. Thank you all for your attention this morning, and I look forward to hearing any discussion from the brethren.
Thank you, Brother Andrew, for those opening remarks. We'll now open the floor for discussion over these two chapters. Brother Austin?
Gene. Yeah, I just had a quick question. We were just talking these chapters. And essentially just kind of wondering what the symbolic meaning is behind the two feasts. Of course, if we look at Esther's two feasts literally, we could say maybe she lost her nerve the first time the king came around, or that perhaps she wanted to curry more favor with him before she did a request. But in the kind of thinking about the symbolic sense, is what is the type of the two feasts and Esther inviting the king, twice and Haman twice?
Brother Dave Humphreys.
I don't have a direct answer to your question, Austin, but one thought I had about this was just thinking about the situation. Esther came in, basically put her life on the line to make a request to the king, who was no doubt was the most powerful man in the world at the time. It seems like the king knew that there was something serious that she was asking for, because when she came forward to him, her request was to have a banquet of wine. So that had to be something more to it than a banquet, and the king knew this. We know, we put ourselves in Esther's shoes, we know from before that she had asked for there to be fasting to prepare for this request. And no doubt she would have been praying for guidance from God in how to approach the situation. So, I put myself in Esther's shoes. You put your life on the line, you come approach the most powerful man in the world, and if he doesn't grant you, you're going to be killed. He does. And at that point, I probably would have just come forward with my request, but she held off. And I'm guessing it's probably due to guidance from God in how she approached it. And then when she had had the first banquet, you know, again, I put myself in Esther's shoes. Would that be the point I'd make the request? Again, if I got to that point, I think I would have. But again, my guess is that probably God had guided her to further delay it and to ask again for another banquet. So there's obviously wisdom in how she proceeded in knowing how to approach the situation. And again, my guess is that this was divine guidance given to her on how to respond to this, given that she'd fasted and no doubt had prayed around the matter. It just reminds me of what Paul says, that he has made all things to all men, that he knows how to approach to different people to get the best result out of them. And it seems like Esther took the same approach here, that she had fasted and prayed to God for guidance. She received that, and we see this kind of ongoing build up to how the request gets made, which is in tomorrow's chapter. So anyway, I just wanted to highlight that point. Brother Andrew had brought that out in brief, and made me think about it a bit more. So, and also thanks, Brother Andrew, for your comments.
Brother Johnny Phillips.
Brothers and sisters, there's so much contained in these few couple of chapters but we see the hand of God in all of it. You know, first of all, in chapter 6, all this plotting is going against the Jews, and it seems like Mordecai's done for. Haman's going to go in and ask for his life. And that night, the night before, the king couldn't sleep. God gives him the insomnia. Why? Well, because it was obvious. He had to have those records read before him, realized Mordecai had saved his life. He said, he saved my life. What was done for him? They looked through the records, nothing. Well, immediately he's going to rectify that. And so it reverses everything Haman has in mind. It's all very interesting. When I was young and Israel was a young nation, the Palestinians used to regularly strap explosive bombs to their young children, to their sons, send them into buses and groups of Jews to blow them up. And when Golda Meir was prime minister, another woman, they asked her, what is it going to take for this to stop? And she said, when the Palestinians start loving their children more than they hate the Jews. And it's very profound, because that's exactly what's happening here. Haman has such a tremendous hatred of Mordecai. He can't see that what he's doing is harming himself. And, it's interesting that Haman's wife and wise men are the ones who prophesy this destruction of Haman and all that he's trying to do. And all this, of course, is a beautiful picture that what would happen, perhaps in answer to Brother Austin's question, we know of two feasts that involve Christ. The one was on the night of his arrest, where he had the first banquet of wine with the breaking of bread. But in the meantime, the gallows is being built. When we look at what happens after that, the says, smite the lintels that the little cups may fall, in effect, that the great persecution that happened to the true believers after the death of Christ is in a sense like that trying to be worked out, that death of the Jews. And but when Christ returns, there's the great marriage supper of the Lamb. There's a great reversal where all the plotting of the world against the Jews, the United Nations is constantly ruling against the Jews every single time. And it will all be reversed, and the Jews will be the head and not the tail. And all the things and the suffering and the persecution that they faced for all these thousands of years now will be reversed, and they will be the top nation in the world.
Brother Freddie?
Just a very quick comment, and thank you, Brother Andrew, for those opening remarks. But Brother Johnny was just bringing out that little back verse there that was the premonition of what was going to happen if they fell before the Jews. And it brought to mind of what happened with Pilate's wife. She took and made caution. She had dreams, that suffered many things by dreams that of what was happening with Christ at his crucifixion. Thank you.
Brother Burrell.
When we look at what happened with Haman, we get a life lesson for ourselves. When you look at Haman and you see the pride of life, because he's upset because Mordecai would not honor him in the gate. So it upsets him. A little drop of bitterness, just one little drop of bitterness, causes his downfall. That little rise, he's on the rise, and he's got this little drop of bitterness, and it mars his happiness. He's no longer happy about what's happening to him. He's upset. You know, it goes like Solomon said when he said, "Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to stink." There it is. You know, he's upset. He's on his, now that was his downfall. He got upset. He had the pride of life, and it ruined his happiness. And the other lesson that we can learn from this is God gives to us, as we do unto others, God gives us and entraps us in our own schemes. And that's exactly what happened to Haman. You know, the gallows which would have hung Mordecai are the gallows which hang Haman. So it's, you know, that which we measure out to people, God will measure out, as he says, he will measure out to us.
Same then, Brother Seth.
I think it's interesting that, like pretty much anytime it's someone else talking about Mordecai, it's Mordecai the Jew. So it was established, and everybody knew that Mordecai was a Jew. And it's Zeresh, Haman's wife, and his friends, his wise men, that tell him, "Oh, build some gallows 50 cubits high, hang Mordecai the Jew on that." And then they go turn around, not but probably just a week or so later, and like, "Oh yeah, well if that's Mordecai the Jew, there's no way you're gonna win against him." So I think it's kind of weird and interesting that they would recommend Haman go against him when they know, or later on say, "Well, there's no way you can beat him if he's gonna be a Jew." So I thought that was a little interesting.
Brother Seth.
Yeah, as we consider that phrase, Mordecai the Jew, I think all of us realize it's possible to read the same chapter year upon year, and little bits and details always just kind of gloss over until all of a sudden they click. That's what happened to me as we read the chapters for the study today, and I noticed that a Brother Andrew saw it as well and mentioned it during his talk. The fact that, yes, Haman angered at Mordecai the Jew, his wife in contempt of Mordecai the Jew, and yet when the king knows the honor has to be bestowed, he just calmly says, "Do this to Mordecai the Jew." And as we're reading, it's like, does he not see the irony? He's putting an honor upon somebody he's condemned to death. But Andrew, brother, pointed out why the king isn't considering this thing. Haman had worded it very carefully. He wrote the document and sealed it. The king didn't even have to see it. It's just, whatever you're saying, it's approved. As far as he could serve, just be this little troublesome tribe out in the middle of the Persian Empire, not a major population. That's how it was in the palace. It was so insular. Everything around the king was so insular, where if you show up unannounced and he doesn't honor you by pointing with a scepter, you're going to be killed. And that is the object lesson right there. We have two commands we have to keep in balance. The first one is, "Come ye out from among them and be ye separate." But we also have to consider what Jesus prayed to his Father: "I pray that thou shouldest not take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil." We're in this world. We have to keep ourselves separate from everything that will corrupt us and turn us away. But unlike the king, we cannot shut anything out so that our inattention will be a harm to others or to ourselves. And that's the important thing. If we're going to ignore everything that's going on in the world, the Lord will come as a thief in the night. So yes, yeah, so we have to be constantly filtering and fighting against the world. But stay aware, stay focused. As was pointed out this week, it's not that Christ comes quickly, he comes suddenly.
Brother Justin?
I'd like to thank Brother Andrew for his opening remarks. Brother Shane touched on the fact that Zeresh and Haman's friends ultimately gave him, the facts of the case, and that advice may have been more useful had it been given to Haman earlier on. And I just got to thinking about our marriages and how. I build houses for a living, and no doubt every single home is going to have something that happens wrong along the way, something that may not meet the home buyer's expectations. And it's almost impossible to overcome the issue if both spouses are emotionally tied and fired up to it. It's so refreshing when you run into a situation where it may be, one spouse is emotionally tied to an issue and they don't have ears to hear, but the other spouse reasons with them and ultimately helps the problem be solved. And, you think about what's going on with Haman and his wife. She ultimately gave him, by stating a fact at the end of the day, she ultimately didn't help Haman, because Haman, Brother Burl mentioned that, the pride of life was at play. Haman didn't have ears to hear. And we all have the same sinful flesh that Haman had. And when we don't have ears to hear, it's the spouse that needs to step up and be that helpmate and say, you're not looking at this right. And ultimately save their spouse from getting into a situation that may ultimately cost their life at the judgment. So, but again, thanks, Brother Andrew, for your opening comments.
Brother Johnny.
Brother and sisters, we have a similar situation, what Christ said to the Laodicean Ecclesia. Now, we realize these represent the time periods and that we're in this lukewarm Laodicean age. But it's interesting what Christ says in light of what we're reading. He says, to him that overcometh, will I grant to sit with me in my throne. What an amazing statement. Now, we know those who get eternal life are equal unto Christ in that they have eternal life. They're never equal unto him in his position and power. Yet he condescends to invite us to sit with him. In a sense, it's what we see with Mordecai as king for a day. He gets his royal apparel, he gets his transportation, he gets a nobleman to lead the horse as a servant, saying, bow the knee, and this is what will be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And that's the great lesson for us, is this is what will be done to us if we make ourselves what the man or woman that God delights to honor. And he says, before that, I will come to him and will sup with him and he with me. So here we see this great banquet, but an amazing opportunity to share Christ's throne with him on earth.
David Somerville.
I'd like to thank our brother for his opening remarks. I think in this section, these two chapters that we read, we see the importance of patience. And that's not something we necessarily have in our day and age. Everything is instant gratification. We do as much as we can and fill up our lives. We don't have the kind of slow down and smell the roses kind of attitude in this country. You see, Esther, is fasting and having, the people fast with her. She goes into the king and petitions for the the banquet. Now, if we think about it, you know, it says the banquet which she had prepared. She'd already done the work. She didn't know what the outcome was going to be. But she, you know, she's fasting. She's not eating. If you're not eating and then you're cooking food, it smells good. You get even more hungrier. But that didn't deter her to do the work that needed to get done. So she was prepared. We see Mordecai, the same thing. He didn't go into the king the next day after he had saved the king's life and say, "Hey, did you see what I did? How come you didn't give me any reward?" He was fine with not receiving the reward. And, you know, obviously it was in God's plan for him to be rewarded on that night and that the next day, and kind of turn the tables on Haman. But if, you know, if we're not patient and let God's plan be worked out and we're looking for our glory that we think we deserve, that can interfere with God's plan. So, you know, we just have to learn to be more patient and do it on his plan, not on our plan.
Brother Burrell, then Brother Seth.
The king gave apparel to be worn to Mordecai. And when we think about this apparel, this is the apparel that the king wore, and this is the apparel he wants to see on those he wants to honor. So we think about the king, we think about our king, we think about Christ. What apparel did he wear, and what apparel does he want to see on us? Well, Christ wore a vesture of truth. That's what he wants to see on us, a vesture of truth. He put on righteousness as a breastplate. That's what he wants to see on us, righteousness as a breastplate. He was clad with zeal as a cloak. That's what he wants to see on us, zeal as a cloak. He wore the whole armor of God. That's what we're to do. Wear the whole armor of God. He was clothed with humility. That's what he wants to see on us. Humility. Be clothed with humility. So we have a nice lesson in what the in whom the king delighteth to honor, what he is to be wearing. The same thing that the king wore himself.
Brother Seth.
Now, here's something about the honoring of Mordecai that leaves me wondering. The king makes the command for Haman to go and do all of these things of honor. Considering the state that Mordecai is in, his clothing is going to have to be changed out of the sackcloth. He's going to have to wash himself to make himself presentable before this ride through the city. But here's what I'm wondering. After the ride of honor was over, we know Mordecai came back to the gate. What I don't know, and what I'm wondering, is if he went back to the sackcloth and ashes, or having gone through this experience, he realized it was turning around and the prayers were being answered. I'd be curious what y'all think about that.
Brother Josh.
I don't have an answer to that question, but just a quick note on Queen Esther and kind of how she took her time the whole time while she was coming up with her way of asking the king her question. She took her time. She gave a lot of thought. Dave Humphreys was saying, you know, if I was her, I would have done it this way or that way. We don't know how God was guiding her. But just for the young kids here, I think many times in our lives, we come to situations where we need to give it a lot of extra thought and take our time and use God's guidance to kind of be our final determining factor on which way we go, whether it's finding a life partner or financial investments. You know, when it comes time to buy a house or buy your first car, you don't want to just go buy the best thing that's out there because it looks the coolest and then you got no money left over. So stuff like that, where I think we can take a lesson from Queen Esther and just kind of take the lesson of patience, seeking out God's guidance. I know for me, this happened like 2 months ago. My cousin at home had a friend. Well, yeah, I would call it a friend who wanted to learn the truth. We're meeting at my house right now in Sunday school. Every Sunday is at my personal home. And he met this guy somewhere. And I kind of felt a little nervous about just having a random stranger come to my house and say, this is what we do, blah, blah, blah. You know, what do you think? So I wanted to meet with him outside of my house first, just to kind of teach him the truth, say, this is what we think, this is what we believe, here's why, and then go from there, you know, as to see if he would be a good fit for our group and what we believe. But I kind of rushed it. I was like, this is my personal house. He was already invited. I didn't know that. I kind of rushed the decision to say, I'll take this guy somewhere else, teach him the truth, you know, my style, introduce him. But I think the way I came across was I pushed him away right away. He was invited. I said, hey, before you come over, let me go here with you. And he felt pushed away. And I think I blew it. So after that, I thought it over. I was like, maybe I should have approached this differently. Now the guy won't even have a conversation with me. So it's like, sometimes maybe you give things a second thought, give it a little bit longer. Don't rush into it. And things might happen a little bit differently. So just some food for thought.
Got time for about one more comment. Brother Dave Somerville.
Give it my thoughts on Seth's question. I don't see him as somebody that would, you know, be celebrating before the victory was won. Even after Haman is hanged, the law is still that the Jews are going to be killed. So he wasn't one that was out for personal victory. I think that's the opposite of Haman and Mordecai. Mordecai wanted to win the personal battle, where Mordecai didn't care. He probably didn't enjoy being brought around because, so I'm exalted, my people still isn't. And, you know, so I just see him not being satisfied until after they were able to write the letter that said the Jews could defend themselves. And that's when it became a victory for Israel. You know, this is still before all that happened. So I see him still in prayer and, you know, maybe being uplifted because he's seeing the tides turn and God is there, which, you know, he expected. That's why, that's what he tells Esther. So, but I don't see him as gaining the victory just yet.